This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One way to make big profits in the global economy is to use slave labor. Unfortunately, there's a plentiful supply of slaves. My guest, Kevin Bales, estimates that about 27 million people are enslaved, more than all the people stolen from Africa during the transatlantic slave trade. Bales serves on the council of the group Anti-Slavery International and has been appointed to the UN Human Rights Commission Working Group on Contemporary Forms of Slavery. He teaches sociology at the University of Surrey in England. Bales has traveled around the world documenting the new slavery, which he says is concentrated in Southeast Asia, Northern and Western Africa, and parts of South America, although there are some slaves in almost every country, including the U.S. He's written a new book called Disposable People. He's found that the new slavery differs in several ways from the slavery of earlier centuries. When the United States had slaves in the South, slavery was legal here and in many other parts of the world. Slavery is illegal around the world now. So how does that affect the nature of the relationship between the owner and the slave?
It affects it in many ways. A lot of times slaveholders will, and notice I use the word holders instead of owners because owning slaves is illegal and people tend to avoid any kind of piece of paper or legal ownership. They want to keep that ownership or that holding of slaves a secret. But they'll often use some kind of a legal mechanism to hide people who are in slavery. They'll often have work contracts, which are completely false, but kept so that they can show them to people if they come around to, if any kind of inspectors or officials come around. But of course, the real differences between the slavery in the United States 150 years ago and those today aren't so much to do with the illegality. They're more to do with the real glut of potential slaves in the world today.
What do you mean?
Well, since the Second World War, you know, we've had this population explosion. We've also had a kind of modernization and globalization of the world economy that's pushed a lot of this large number of new people into economic vulnerability. Now, you get literally billions of people into a position of vulnerability, and they become much easier to enslave if the governments in which they live simply don't enforce the laws against slavery. So if there's corruption in a state, in a government, and there are plenty of people who are economically vulnerable, people who will use violence can use that violence to enslave others. And that's exactly what's happening.
In this global economy, a lot of multinationals produce their products in developing countries where the labor is really cheap. Do you have any reason to suspect that any multinationals actually benefit from slave labor?
Well, yes, I do. It has to be said that it would be very rare, and I can't say that I know of any multinationals that are directly using slave labor. What's happening is that multinationals subcontract in developing countries, and they subcontract to people who do use slave labor. And those bits of raw material that might be processed up and then sold on to multinational companies can sometimes use slave labor. The best example of that is probably in Brazil, where the international steel industry of Brazil uses charcoal, which is produced primarily with slave labor in Western Brazil.
So the multinationals don't necessarily directly hire the slaves, but they subcontract to people who do.
That's
and
right.
Therefore, the multinationals benefit from
well, in fact,
the cheap
I think
free labor. Yeah,
I think we have to face up to the fact there's a good chance we all may be benefiting. Because if multinationals are benefiting from cheap raw materials because their subcontractors are using slave labor, then any of us who've got stocks and shares or pension funds, that sort of thing, with investments in those multinationals, it means that we're profiting from it as well.
And it probably also means that sometimes when we buy a product that seems astoundingly cheap, one of the reasons might be slave labor somewhere along the line?
Yeah, it's possible. Certainly, you know, the situation in India is another example of this, because in India, bonded labor, which is a kind of slavery, is used very extensively in agriculture. Now, this means that the price of food in India is incredibly low, and it means that workers in India, and Pakistan is the same situation, can be paid much less than workers in the West.
What is bonded labor?
Bonded labor is when someone takes a debt, borrows money, but as collateral against the debt, they put up basically their whole life. And unfortunately, it's true that these debt bonds are accounted in a sort of fictitious way, and it means that the debt can even be passed on for generations. So a classic example of this would be an agricultural worker in India needs money perhaps to buy medicine for his children. So he goes to a landlord and says, I've got to borrow some money. The landlord says, I can loan you the money, but you don't have anything to put up for collateral except your own effort, your own work. So what you have to do is, in a sense, become a slave to me until this debt is paid off. Now, the accounting on the debt is completely controlled by the landlord. The worker is usually illiterate, and this means that interest can be added, extra charges can be added, and at the end of the day, the debt will grow, never shrink, against the work of the bonded laborer. So, for example, in India, I met people who had been bonded laborers all their lives, and the debt that they owed to the landlord was not one that they had contracted or their fathers, but their grandfathers had contracted the debt.
Well, so they're still paying that off, and they probably never will pay it off.
It's very unlikely that they will. They in fact, usually the debt increases.
Well, does the slaveholder charge for room and board, even though the person is being forced to stay there?
Usually not charge for room and board. But what they will do is that any other kind of emergency that might come up, another need for medicine for the children, or perhaps some fertilizer or some new clothes or the cost of a funeral, the debt-bonded slave will have to go back and say, I need a little more money, and that'll be added to the debt.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kevin Bales, and he's the author of a new book called Disposable People, New Slavery in the Global Economy. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Kevin Bales is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Disposable People, New Slavery in the Global Economy. He serves on the Council of Anti-Slavery International, and he's a member of the UN Human Rights Commission Working Group on Contemporary Forms of Slavery. You make some very interesting comparisons between slavery as it was managed back in the days when slavery was legal in many parts of the world and slavery as it's handled now. You say that slaves used to be owned for life, and now slavery is a much more short-term proposition, and a lot of slaves are considered disposable. What do you mean by that?
Well, I have to say I mean that quite literally. Slaves are now so cheap that they've stopped being any kind of investment, and they're really more like buying a plastic pen or a throwaway lighter. They're the cheapest they've been in the entire history of the planet, as far as I can tell, looking through all the histories. There's such a glut of potential slaves since the population explosion since the Second World War that slaves have just fallen in value to the point that you can buy a slave for a tiny fraction of what a slave might have cost 150 years ago. Shall I give you an example of
that?
Sure,
please.
Well, if we went back, say, to 1850 and the state of Mississippi, you could buy a slave for an average slave. It would cost about $1,000. Now, in modern money, $1,000 in 1850 is about $60,000 to $80,000. So you can see that they were making a sizable investment. Today, you can buy a slave similar to the one you might have bought in Mississippi in 1850 for, say, $50 to $100. And that's current money. The price of slaves is so low that they're no longer investments. They're simply additions to the money-making process. And it means that when your slave gets sick or gets unruly or simply isn't needed anymore, you can just dispose of them.
What does dispose of them mean? Fire them or something worse than that?
Well, usually something worse. Sometimes not, but often something worse. Many slaves, when their usefulness is gone, are just abandoned. That's certainly the case in Brazil. People are just left out in the forest. People drive away and leave them out in the forest, and they have to find their way somehow, sometimes more than 1,000 miles back to their homes. In other situations, though, particularly when slaves are troublesome, often it's easier just to kill them. And certainly, there are slaves around the world who are killed because They don't really want to be in slavery. In Thailand, where I looked carefully at the working class brothels in Thailand, where young women are enslaved, the dumping of these young women usually occurs when they test positive for HIV.
And by dumped, that means they're just
thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
They're just thrown out onto the street. And
that sounds like it could be a change for the better.
Well, yes, it's possible. I suppose it could be a change for the better, and sometimes it is. I have to say, sometimes it is. It's a kind of liberation. It's probably not the best kind of liberation, but it's a kind of liberation. Of course, now they're trying to deal with the fact that they're HIV positive for these girls in Thailand, and that's a pretty tough challenge for them.
And I imagine having been in servitude and prostitution doesn't exactly help them get new jobs or even reunite with family.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it's curious that we have in the Western countries, in the Northern countries, a lot of thought and time has been given to developing ways to help people who have been traumatized, say, through domestic violence or from exposure to other forms of violence. But there is no sort of discipline for the counseling of liberated slaves. No one's actually working on the best ways to help counsel or bring therapy to people who've been liberated out of slavery.
Now, another interesting comparison you make between what slavery used to be and what it is now, you say that slaves used to be the other, and they were considered the other either because they were from a conquered population or they were from a different country or a different ethnic group. They looked different, and that would help the slave owners rationalize and justify the fact that they own slavery. But now you say it's just purely an economic proposition. There's not necessarily any kind of, you know, ethnic or racial difference.
There are some ethnic and racial differences, but they've ceased to be very important. And a lot of times those ethnic and racial differences are in fact just standing in for economic differences. So that if we go back to India for a moment, or to Pakistan, but Pakistan's a good example. A large number of the people who are enslaved in the brick making industry are Christians, in Pakistan, but there are a lot of Christians who are not enslaved. You know, they're not being enslaved because they're Christians and because they're ethnically different for that reason. They're being enslaved because they're economically vulnerable, and of course, in many countries of the world, there are people enslaving people of their own ethnic group. So that in West Africa, people are enslaving people of their own ethnic group. And the same is true in Thailand or India.
Now, you say that a lot of the new slaves are slaves because they're so economically vulnerable. In many parts of the world, women are particularly vulnerable, both economically and sexually. Do you think that women are more vulnerable in terms of getting sold into slavery?
Oh, I think that almost goes without saying. The economic vulnerability of women, and particularly the way women are seen in some cultures, means that their value is diminished. And so you have, and again, Thailand is a perfect example of this, families selling young girls into slavery in a way that they would never do with boy children. They'll sell girl children into slavery.
What would parents get for a girl, for a daughter they were selling into slavery?
In Thailand, I'm sorry to have to say it in these ways, but for a nice-looking young girl, say of 13, 14, something around $1,000, or sometimes merchandise, sometimes a new refrigerator or a color television.
Have you ever spoken to a parent in Thailand who sold their daughter into slavery?
Yes, once. I had a conversation with the mother of a 15-year-old girl who had been enslaved into prostitution in eastern Thailand.
What did she tell you about it?
Well, you know, she said that she rationalized. I mean, and this is, of course, the case with slaveholders as well. They have tremendous powers of rationalization. But she said that, the family needed this money, and that it was unfortunate that she had to sell Siri in this way. The girl's name was Siri. She had known other families, though, who had successfully sold girls into prostitution, and that she hoped that someday she would be able to come back and join them in the village. But I have to say, she wasn't very forthcoming. She wasn't very forthcoming. She didn't like the line of questioning.
And if you spoke to young women who were sold into slavery by their parents?
Oh, yes. Though I have to say that staying on these young women in Thailand, it's important to remember that they are fundamentally Buddhist young women. And as part of their religious orientation, they move quickly to an attempt to accept what has happened to them. So often by the time I would speak to them, they would say, well, obviously this is my fate, this is my karma. I don't know what I've done in a previous life to lead to this turn of events, but it's something I'm just going to have to accept.
Hmm. And you interviewed slave owners. Were you able to talk with them about their rationales for owning slaves?
Yes, particularly in Pakistan and India. I didn't say I'm here to study slavery. I tended to say I'm here to study agriculture. And I would get slaveholders talking about their crops and their livestock and let them come around to the question of labor. But, you know, the kind of rationalizations that I got were exactly the sort that you might read that were written by someone in Alabama in 1850. They would say, you know, these people, if we didn't take care of them, they'd just completely mess their lives up. You know, if you give them any money, they drink it up. They're illiterate and they're really not educable and they don't know how to control themselves and they don't know how to live their lives. And really, we're like fathers to them. We take good care of them. And if it weren't for slavery, they'd be in big trouble.
That has a familiar ring to it.
Yeah, didn't it? I was kind of shocked sometimes when my interpreter in India would come back with these words that sounded just exactly like things I had read coming out of the Deep South of 150 years ago.
Throughout history, there have been stories of slave rebellions. Are there any equivalents today?
Oh, yes. Particularly in countries like India and Pakistan, where bonded laborers have begun to work together to liberate themselves. Now, in many ways, it's easier because remember that in the past, we were talking about slave rebellions in a situation in which slavery was legal. Now, if those bonded laborers or slaves who want to get out of slavery can swing government support behind them, it makes it much easier for them to get out of slavery. That's a crucial question, though, because one of the key ingredients to slavery around the world is governmental corruption.
My guest is Kevin Bales, author of a new book about the new slavery called Disposable People. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kevin Bales. He's the author of the new book Disposable People, New Slavery in the Global Economy. He also serves on the Council of Anti-Slavery International, and he's a member of the UN Human Rights Commission Working Group on Contemporary Forms of Slavery. Do you have any suggestions on what the international community could do to try to stop contemporary slavery?
Well, I've got a few ideas. One of the things I did in this book was to look very carefully at the economics of new slavery, of contemporary slavery, because we tend to think of it as a human rights outrage. And of course, it is a human rights outrage, but people don't enslave others to be mean to them. People enslave other people because they want to use them economically. And I think we've got to come to understand the economic links all along the product chain which tie possibly us in the Western world and the Northern world to slaves in the developing world. That's one thing. That operates at then a number of levels, so that you have an organization like the World Trade Organization, which is able to put economic sanctions on countries and governments. At the moment, the WTO charter doesn't include putting sanctions on a country because of human rights violations, only because of financial or commercial violations. I think one of the things that we need to do right away is to move in that direction, is to include human rights and particularly slavery as one of those things that means that the WTO can use to impose economic sanctions on countries where slavery exists.
Now, I know some I guess charities are trying to buy slaves away from their owners, but that's actually very controversial. What's the controversy about?
Well, gosh, you're right. It is very controversial. In Sudan, there has been the enslavement of Christian tribes in the south of Sudan by Muslim tribes from the north of Sudan, and it's all part of the civil war, which has been going on in the Sudan for a long time. There are some American Christian organizations which have been involved in going to Muslim slaveholders and buying back large numbers of these enslaved Dinka tribespeople. Now, of course, you know, it is controversial because if we look on the positive side, yes, they're buying people out of slavery. The people are being liberated. They are freed and able to return to the villages that they were captured from. But on the negative side, of course, and I've seen documentary footage of this, they're handing over a lot of money to people who are involved in capturing and holding and exploiting slaves. In a sense, they're feeding into the slavery system. Also, it has to be said that liberating people really isn't enough. You know, being enslaved is suffering a very terrible trauma. And these people need rehabilitation, and they need usually counseling and therapy as well. Buying them out of slavery is just the first step. If you really want to change their lives and make them secure against future enslavement, you've got to rehabilitate them financially as well. Now, I don't see that happening, and that's one of the reasons I worry about this process.
Well, I guess it doesn't really do much to change the slave system, because if you buy out, say, 15 slaves from this one slaveholder, he makes a profit and then uses the money to buy new slaves, and maybe he'd buy the new slaves at a cheaper rate than he was paid to liberate the old ones, so he still ends up making a profit and getting fresh blood.
Well, that's right. And of course, in fact, the introduction of this Western capital has been driving the price up, not down. Though it has to be said that that other international pressure on Sudan has been causing that civil war to die back a bit and diminishing the situation in which violence can be used to enslave other people. But it's still a very tricky situation in Sudan, and there's still a lot of people with guns who are happy to go out and capture others and enslave them.
Were you ever put on the spot by a slave who asked you to help buy them out?
No, I have to say never. Never. I think I had to think about it a lot before I went out to do the field work, and I thought that this might happen. But in fact, I found slaves remarkably resigned to the situations they were in, hoping for the best, but understanding that it could be a long haul before they got out.
What had you resigned to do if somebody did ask?
Well, it would have to be determined by the situation. There were certainly cases in Thailand where I would meet very young women who were enslaved into prostitution. The situation there was horrific, to say the least. You know, these young girls were sold to 15 to 20 men per night and brutalized in the meantime. And any human being's inclination would be to try and take them out of that situation instantly. But it's also true that had I tried to do so, my informants would have been under threat of violence, if not death, and that it would have been probably about helping one person in a way that meant that I was not able to help, I hope, thousands by making an expose of the situation, which is there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your findings with us about new slavery. Thank you.
Certainly.
Kevin Bales is the author of the new book, Disposable People, New Slavery in the Global Economy. He teaches at the University of Surrey in England.